Good afternoon. My name is Steve Luckabaugh, and I'd like to welcome you to the Routine HIV Testing Community of Practice Session Number 2 webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the Partnerships for Care HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, or HIV-TAC. The Partnerships for Care project is a three-year multi-agency project funded by the Secretary's Minority AIDS Initiative Fund and the Affordable Care Act. The goals of the project are to, one, expand provision of HIV testing, prevention, care, and treatment in health centers serving communities highly impacted by HIV. Two, to build sustainable partnerships between health centers and their state health department. And three, improve health outcomes among people living with HIV, especially among racial and ethnic minorities. The project is supported by the HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, or HIV-TAC. At this point, I will turn things over to Victor Ramirez at MyoTech. Victor?
Thank you very much, Steve. I'd like to welcome everybody to our community of practice and routine HIV testing today. Thank you again to the Denver Prevention Training Center for being the lead faculty. Just a reminder, this community of practice encompasses four sessions. The first one occurred last month on February 11th, the one today, and then two upcoming sessions on April 14th and May 5th. Now, all the communities of practice are being recorded and they can be accessed at the P4C website. I'd also like to use this opportunity to invite everybody to our new community of practice that will be beginning on March 22nd on electronic medical records. This information has been transmitted through the P4C listserv, so you should have received some information about it. And again, just to invite you to come and attend or to forward the information to staff in your health center who might be interested in this topic. And before I turn everything over to Dr. Karen Wendell from Denver Prevention Training Center, I would like to add that we Denver Prevention Training Center would appreciate 1 to 2 minutes of your time to complete a registration form for this series that they are leading as leading faculty. So please, whenever you get a chance, either after this webinar, please go and visit this website and complete the registration. Again, it's a very short form. The information will be very useful for Denver Prevention Training Center to be able to develop content for the third and fourth sessions of this series. All right, so without further delay, I'd like to pass it back to Steve.
Okay, thank you, Victor. Our first speaker today is Dr. Karen Wendell. Dr. Wendell is the Director of HIV-STD Prevention and Control at Denver Public Health, an Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Colorado Health Science Center Division of Infectious Diseases. She received her medical degree at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and completed internal medicine training and infectious disease fellowship at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. She has been involved in HIV and STD clinical care and research while on faculty at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Oklahoma Health Science Center, and the University of Colorado Health Science Center. While in Baltimore, she served as the Director of Early Intervention Initiative for HIV Care in the Baltimore City Health Department STD Clinics, and while in Oklahoma, served as the Medical Director for the Oklahoma City County Health Department STD Clinic. In addition to her academic and public health experience, Dr. Wendell has worked for several years in private practice in the area of infectious diseases. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wendell.
Thank you, Steve. So this is Karen Wendell from the Denver Prevention Training Center. The Denver Prevention Training Center has been funded for over 3 decades to provide training, technical assistance, and consultation to clinical providers nationally at no cost on HIV and STI prevention and care. You can visit us at thedenverptc.org. We're very excited to be here today in partnership with MyoTech to discuss HIV testing technologies. Our objectives today are to describe the evolution of HIV testing from first generation to our current antigen and antibody tests, to review the time from HIV infection to positive testing by method that we use, and review the CDC HIV testing algorithm and the rationale for it. We'll discuss limitations of the fourth generation point of care HIV testing that is available currently, and if we have time, we'll discuss 2 cases. The evolution of HIV testing began with first generation tests that were done with whole viral lysate detecting IgG antibodies in the patient. Second generation testing used synthetic peptides and sort of very minimally narrowed the window of detection of HIV infection, again, only detecting IgG antibodies. For clinicians, I think we're all aware that IgM antibody is the first to become detectable and then is followed by the development of IgG. And therefore, third-generation tests really took advantage of this, using synthetic peptides, detecting IgM and IgG, and closing down the window fairly significantly. And finally, the current state of art is the use of not only IgM and IgG detection, but the use of detection of P24 antigen of HIV-1, which allows for very early detection and detection in the acute infection window. This slide just gives you an idea of the FDA-approved tests that have been available in the United States to detect HIV. And, you know, progressing through first generation, second generation, third generation, and fourth, many are wanting to move away from the generation designation because it can be somewhat confusing and there can be some overlap. And currently, what we really are focusing on is naming the test more by what it is looking at. So what we're calling fourth-generation tests are really tests that are looking at that P24 antigen and also able to detect HIV, IgM, and IgG responses in the client. You can see that many of the third-generation manufacturers like Bio-Rad, Siemens, and Centaur also have fourth-generation products and likely will phase out these third-generation tests. I want to draw your attention to that salmon-colored row, and these are really tests that are point-of-care, CLIA-waived tests, and you can see there's a fair array of these, but only one in the fourth-generation column, which is the Allele-determined combo antigen-antibody test. In addition, we have two tests that sort of cross between descriptions of second and third generation. These are the INSTI-HIV-1 and 2 and the Unigold. So it is marketed currently as a third-generation test, but it's felt to function primarily more on a second-generation type of detection, time-to-detection standard. Finally, when we're talking about HIV infection, and especially acute infection, we may have to use nucleic acid amplification tests to really determine if a patient is infected. And these tests come both as qualitative and quantitative tests. The use of these tests for HIV diagnosis is off-label. But as I stated, they are used in an acute infection window that has now been considerably resolved by the presence of the P24 antigen. This diagram sort of shows you what I'm talking about here. I want to draw your attention to this and go through each of the elements of the diagram. First of all, just to go over the x-axis, the point zero is the time of infection in the patient, and all the time points along that x-axis are days from that initial infection. You can see that the first thing to be detectable is HIV RNA, and that has a very dramatic rise and then comes down to what we refer to as the set point. And this set point is where patients can live sort of in the absence of therapy for many years before they progress on into AIDS and more complicated HIV disease. The next biomarker to rise is the HIV P24 antigen, which has a fairly short window. You can see that it's starting to shoot up around day 17, but it's come down to near zero by day 45. And then finally, you can see antibody responses. So that first hill that you see in that antibody response is primarily that IgM response. And then you see the slow and steady increased response in IgG. So on the bottom part of this slide, you can see where the first generation test is able to detect. And it's notable that it is only at around day 55 that it's able to pick up signal for IgG. Second generation tests, when they incorporate synthetic peptides, narrowed that window slightly to around 45 days. And then the third generation tests, when we incorporate that IgM detection, we're coming down to about a 3-week window. The fourth generation test, going down to about a 17-day window in general. And the nucleic acid amplification test is and remains the most sensitive for picking up infection in the acute window and is able to pick up virus starting at around 10 days after infection. That period between 0 to 10 days is known as the eclipse period, where we have no diagnostics that could determine if a patient has sustained an HIV infection. This is the CDC algorithm for HIV testing. And you can see that CDC has incorporated the fourth generation testing, meaning the antigen-antibody combination immunoassay, as the first recommended test. And when we look at this diagram, it's important to note this is the lab-based antigen-antibody combination immunoassay. If that test is negative, you're done. Your patient does not have HIV by this diagnostic. If it's positive, these lab-based tests pick up P24, IgM, and IgG, but do not differentiate between those. So moving on to the HIV-1, HIV-2 antibody differentiation immunoassay lets us know, do we have HIV-1, HIV-2, or do we have an indeterminate or negative test? If the test, and you can see this on the right-hand side of your slide, is indeterminate or negative, then you question whether this is a positive P24 case, in which case to confirm this diagnosis, you would need the use of the nucleic acid amplification test. And so you can see that the branch here goes to a positive nucleic acid amplification test, which shows acute HIV infection, or a negative test suggesting there is no presence of HIV-1. But why has the CDC moved to this fourth generation? Certainly the graph was very impressive, but we have multiple studies that have demonstrated the potential power of these fourth generation tests. Here I've only shown us one significant study done by Pandori et al. In Journal of Clinical Microbiology in 2009. They looked at 64 well-characterized specimens from recently infected individuals. Of these, 35 samples were from patients who had HIV RNA positive but on third-generation testing were negative, so representing a very acute infection population. They took these samples and ran it against the Architect antigen-antibody combo test, a fourth-generation test. And what they found is that the Architect was able to pick up 25 of 35 of these acute infections, so 80%, with this new testing modality. So certainly very encouraging. When they looked at all of the samples, all 64, and they were all from early infections, so the first 6 months, they compared different assays for us, and you can see that the percent detection of those early samples really ranged quite widely. So with the Western blot, only 12% identified. With the multi-spot, which is our current HIV-1, HIV-2 differentiation assay, 28% were identified. With the Unigold, 34%, and with third-generation immunoassay, 42%, and then you can see how well this fourth-generation test did at 89% detection of all of these early infections. Well, why do we care so much? I think as clinicians, we all want to make the right diagnosis. We want to give our patient the right information. We don't want to tell them they're HIV negative when they really truly have HIV infection. But more than that, we also want to protect those around them. And so when we inform a patient of their HIV status, certainly there's the potential to reduce risk behaviors and also to link them to care, which would entail the initiation of antiretroviral therapy, which we know can lower their HIV viral load. What we know from data that's been presented is that 10 to 15% of all new HIV transmissions can be attributed to acute infection, especially in patients with multiple sex partners. So why is this the case? When we look at that natural curve, this is without treatment, what is the natural history of the viral load in an HIV-infected patient? That's represented by that yellow line there, and you can see that there's a very high first peak in that HIV viral load, and as we discussed previously, then it comes down to a much lower set point. So when you look at that, several studies have sort of looked at this and sort of come up with a potential risk of HIV transmission per coital act. So an acute HIV infection, the risk can be anywhere from 1 to 50 to 1 out of 250. But when they've come down to their set point, the rate can decrease significantly to per coital act down to 1 to 1,000 to up to 1 to 10,000. So much reduced risk with each sexual act of transmission of the HIV virus. So I think I've probably convinced you that this fourth generation test is important to institute. But what happened to our Western blot? Well, I think what's important to know here is that we've moved to the HIV-1, HIV-2 differentiation assay because it's faster than performing a Western blot. It's more reliable at differentiating between HIV-1 and HIV-2. And it detects disease earlier in infection, therefore sort of limiting that indeterminate type of result. Currently, we're using the multi-spot. Around December of 2016, it will, in most labs, switch to the Genius test. I'd like to move on to fourth-generation point-of-care testing because this can be somewhat confusing. As I stated, there's only one test that's on the market currently, and that's the Determine HIV 1 and 2 antigen-antibody combo test. And it, unlike the lab-based test for fourth generation, it does separate out the P24 antigen from the antibody responses. What you see over there is a cartoon of the test strip. The blood is placed on the left-hand side and through capillary flow is drawn up through that test strip. If the antibody is positive, it creates that first thin red line. If the antigen P24 is positive, it creates the second thin line. And then all of the test strips, you want to see the internal control line, the third thin red line, become positive. And this test is resulted within 15 minutes and is very convenient. But how does it perform? Let's look at the next slide. The package insert says it has a sensitivity of 99.9% on serum, plasma, and whole blood, with a specificity of 99% to 100 with serum, plasma, and whole blood. In CDC studies on plasma collected during seroconversion, so again, these are acute infection patients, the determined combo detected infection 1 to 2 weeks before other rapid tests, and 1 to 3 days before a third-generation laboratory test, but 3 to 4 days after the fourth-generation laboratory test. The key issue, though, is that there is very limited data on the sensitivity of the rapid HIV test when used on whole blood specimens, which is the standard. Recently, a systematic review was published by Lewis and colleagues in AIDS. This study looked at the use of the determined HIV 1 and 2 antigen antibody test across 4 different studies, looking at over 17,000 participants. The study sites were in Australia, Swaziland, United Kingdom, and Malawi. They did a focus on looking at the P24 component and determining how it performed across the 4 studies. And across the studies, they had a total of 26 acute infections, and all of them were missed by the LEER determined. In addition, there were 35 positive results. They were all false positives. So the positive predictive value of the P24 component used on whole blood was 0%. In addition, they looked at the antibody component. As we stated, the fourth generation tests not only have the benefit of the P24 antigen, but they do have the IgM antibody component. So in 1 study, 0 out of 3 cases of acute HIV infection were detected by the antibody component of the test. And in 1 study, 2 out of 8 cases of acute HIV infection were detected by that combined IgM-IgG antibody component, so 25%. I think with these results, we can see why the use of these point-of-care tests has not been incorporated into the algorithm at present. And therefore, if you have a positive point-of-care test, the next step is the standard flow through the algorithm with a fourth-generation lab-based test. The data are just insufficient to recommend these tests at this time as the initial assay in the laboratory algorithm. So I'd like to go through some cases if we have time. They'll be fairly quick, but they're real cases, and they sort of point out, I believe, why these algorithms are important and why clinicians need to have them in mind. So here at Denver Health, we had presentation of a 35-year-old man with a positive point-of-care test at an outside site. This test was the determine a LEER combo test. From there, the patient had been seen by a primary care provider who went straight from the combo test to an HIV viral load and CD4 count. The results of those tests showed a viral load that was undetectable and a CD4 count that was 350. The primary provider was then confused by the results and referred the patient to infectious disease for consultation. So these are not polling questions, but I'd like you to think about these, and then I'm going to tell you about what happened. What do you tell this patient? It looks like you don't have HIV. The point of care test was wrong. Or B, we need to do more HIV testing to clarify your HIV status. C, I believe you have HIV based on your point of care HIV test and CD4 count. Let's repeat your viral load. What do you order next? A repeat HIV viral load? A lab-based fourth-generation HIV test? An HIV genotype, or a repeat HIV point-of-care test? Now, if you've been paying attention, you know the right answer. And the right answer is to get that fourth-generation HIV test. Follow the algorithm. Why does this patient have such confusing results? Well, I'll give you a little more history. This patient is from West Africa, and indeed, with further testing, it was determined that the patient had HIV-2. HIV-2 will not be picked up by the HIV-1 nucleic acid amplification test, and therefore, following the algorithm will help you determine this and will diminish the rates of sort of confusing results that delay care and cause more concern and fear in the patient. Case number 2. The results of patient testing showed an HIV-1-2 antigen antibody combo test that was positive. The HIV-1-HIV-2 antibody differentiation immunoassay was negative. Therefore, following the algorithm, an HIV viral load was performed and showed a viral load of 345,000. What's the diagnosis here? A false negative antibody differentiation immunoassay, acute HIV infection, or chronic HIV infection? Again, I think we went through this in the algorithm. This is the standard process for determining a patient who has acute HIV infection. And as we've seen, the antibody differentiation immunoassay, which is a second generation test, will have a delay in its positivity and will be seen to be positive on repeat testing. That's all I've got, and I'd like to open it up for any questions before we move on.
Okay, I'm not seeing any questions right now. Should we go ahead and move on? Okay, our second speaker today is Ms. Andrea Brooks. Ms. Brooks is currently the Performance Improvement Manager at Broward Community and Family Health Centers, Inc. in Hollywood, Florida, and serves as the project lead for their P4C project. She has over 15 years of experience in program development and administration, monitoring and evaluation, and grant management, and previously worked as an HIV program manager with Healthcare for the Homeless, FHQC, in Miami, Florida for over 4 years. She is also a fellow of the CDC's Institute for HIV Prevention Leadership, an NCQA patient-centered medical home certified content expert, and has extensive experience as a health educator and capacity building trainer. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Brooks.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm definitely excited to be a part of this presentation, and Dr. Wendell definitely opened up one of the discussions that we at Broward Community Family Health Center had to have. So this afternoon, we're just going to go ahead and talk to you guys a little bit about how we went ahead and decided to implement routine HIV testing at our site. So some of the key topics that I'd like to discuss is just give you an overview of our community health center and talk about how we went about integrating routine HIV testing at our site. But most importantly, really want to spend most of my time talking about how we went about selecting our testing technology from the list that Dr. Wendell provided as well, and then give you a couple of next steps as to where we are with regard to sustaining our program here. So Broward Community Family Health Center, we were established in 1998 in Broward County, Florida. Our mission is to provide accessible, comprehensive health, high-quality primary health care services to people with a level of dignity and respect. We basically operate 4 primary care centers. We're getting ready to open a dental center in May, so we're excited about that. We have about 88 employees, and that list seems to continue to grow, and are 47% federally funded. So our patient population, in 2015, we served approximately 8,416 patients. We served a variety of patients. They distributed race, primarily Black or African American. With regard to ethnicity, we have a large Hispanic population here in South Florida, and the patients that we serve represent that as well. Amongst our patients that we serve, we had a total of 327 HIV-positive individuals that we served during the last year. So for us, integrating routine HIV testing, so one of the things with our community health center, again, we've been around for quite a while. We've always provided services to the HIV population. We're Ryan White funded, but we had not done routine HIV testing up until this point with the implementation of the P4C project. We had been doing risk-based testing, so patients either that a provider identified had been engaging in some type of at-risk behavior, or people who came in and just requested a test because they knew that we were a registered testing site. And so for that, when we decided that we wanted to join the Partnership for Care project, we knew that we needed to look at routine testing. We knew it was something that we wanted to do, and how would we do it. So basically, our first step was to identify who would we test? Who would we look to provide routine testing? And we basically went off of the CDC's recommendation. So all of our new health center patients that fell within the age range would be tested. Anyone who didn't have any documented HIV test. So we would look in their history, see whether or not they had been tested. If they hadn't, we'd go ahead and offer them the test. Again, we're also not just looking at the age. We want to, those who had increased risk for HIV, we would definitely go ahead and test them at least once. If they had risk, we want to test them over. We would definitely recommend that. And of course, all pregnant women with unknown HIV status, we would test them both during the first trimester. If they entered care later than that, then we would again test them as soon as they entered there. And of course, they'd be tested again during the third trimester. So this diagram, pretty busy, but just wanted to give you an idea of what that workflow looks for us. So when we have patients who we are going to introduce routine testing to, how does it happen? So basically what this outlines is we identify the patients that we're going to test. That risk information is still collected. And so we know that although we're not testing them just based off of risk, we still want to make sure that we're collecting risk information so we know if they need to have or be referred to any other HIV prevention, high-impact prevention modalities. So then the provider is the one who provides them education about HIV. The medical assistant at intake, they may offer them some education or may not, but we definitely want to make sure that that conversation is happening with the providers because we think the patients respond a little bit differently when the providers are having a discussion. And then we decided that we were going to do routine testing. We were going to do a blood-based test, and we would have that blood-based test happen along with any other labs that the patients were asked to complete. So for our lab-based test, we were trying to decide for routine testing whether or not we wanted to do a lab-based test or a rapid test. I already alluded to the fact that we chose to go with lab-based, but these were some of the things that we had to pay attention to. We weighed the pros and the cons. So for lab-based testing, again, we felt that the patients were more acceptable to a lab-based test if it was introduced by their provider. You want me to take another test? Why? The providers can have a different answer to that conversation, and so that seems to work for us. We, again, thought it was easier to include with other labs. We knew this was the recommendation of CDC. We looked at the different generations of tests. We decided to go with a fourth-generation test, as Dr. Wendell referenced, and we knew that there wouldn't necessarily be an additional test that was needed before we could make the patients to care, versus with the rapid test, that would be something we knew we would have to do a confirmatory test with. Some of the cons of the lab-based test, we were concerned about the fact that we might potentially lose some of our patients to care, that they just wouldn't return for that lab visit. So for most of you, if you're working in a clinic, you know, at least in our clinic, one of the things that we do, some of the labs they have to be fasting labs, depending on the time that they have to do that lab, the time of their visit. They may have to come back to the lab. The lab may not be done on the same day. So one of the things that we were thinking about when we made this decision was, do we do that blood-based test the same day, or would we offer it when they came back for the regular lab? Again, we were also concerned about delayed entry into care for patients who were HIV positive. One, with the lab-based test, we knew that, again, we were waiting for the patients to come back for another appointment. At that next appointment is when we would give them their results as well as link them to care. We were concerned about the increased lab costs for our uninsured patients, and we were, of course, doing more lab-based testing also as additional organizational costs with regard to the processing, the supplies, X, Y, and Z. So those were the things we took into consideration. When we looked at the rapid testing, Broward Community Family Health Center is a state-funded testing site, and so we actually get our tests kits free of charge from the Department of Health. We knew patients were still coming in. There were some people who come in just generally off the street and want to take an HIV test, and they prefer to have a rapid test. They're not there as a patient. They're not there to initiate services. They just want to find out what their HIV status is for whatever their reason. So we knew that that was a pro of still offering the rapid test, and we could give them the same day results. Again, for the most part, knowing that we'd have to do confirmatory tests, but they'd still be able to walk out of there with some type of result the same day that they walked in. Some of the cons that we had to consider with rapid testing were the fact that we would have to do additional documentation. Again, because we're a testing site, we have to do additional documentation to provide that to our local health department. If we increase the number of tests that we did, that just means a whole lot more paperwork, something that our staff weren't the most excited about, especially since we transitioned to an electronic health record system. We also knew that there would have to be additional training that was required for our testers. Part of that is because they have to be trained through our local Department of Health. Those trainings have to happen before they can even begin initiating testing services. And so we were a little concerned about the delay in our ability to do that. So in the end, we decided to go ahead with lab-based testing. So for us, we decided to, for our routine testing, it would be based off of a lab, a blood-based test. Again, the test would be conducted by the MA along with other labs. We were happy to know that the lab costs for most of our insured patients, we were able to bill it for the insurance. We had a couple of insurances that we had to negotiate that, have that conversation to make sure that that would be a covered test. But for the most part, it was already covered, so that didn't require too much negotiation. And we were able to negotiate with regard to our P4C grant for them to cover the cost of labs for any of our uninsured or self-pay patients. But we decided we didn't want to let go of rapid testing totally, so we're also continuing to do rapid testing for community members or non-patients. Basically, those people who are coming in, they may have been identified us as a testing site through an outreach event, through a recommendation from somebody else, someone who previously came there, let them know, hey, you can come, you can get the test done at no cost to you. You don't have to become a patient at that center, but this is a way that you can definitely become aware of your status. And again, because the testing kits are provided by our State Department of Health, that definitely gave us even some more incentive to continue offering that service and program. So with us implementing routine testing, we knew that additional training would be needed, both for the introduction of lab or blood-based tests, as well as for the continuation of our routine testing. So one of the things that we needed to do, we had to provide additional education just around HIV education to our general staff. We have some staff here who were certified, who were previously certified to do the HIV education, but now because more people would be involved in the process, we wanted to make sure that everyone had a basic knowledge set and could provide and answer some of the questions that might come to patients that they didn't want to ask in front of their provider. We also did some additional training around just the routine testing workflow. What would it look like? What should you do if a patient comes in here, they need to be tested? If one of our patient care coordinators identify that a patient has not been tested, then what should the next steps look like? How do we follow that process? What does it look like? For our rapid testing staff, we identify which staff amongst our organization that we want to make sure could continue to provide rapid testing. So again, we have four sites. The majority of our staff that were certified to do testing were located at one of our sites, and that's where we provide the majority of our HIV care, coincidentally. But we decided that we wanted to make sure that we had staff at each of our sites who could still offer rapid testing. So we decided that all of our outreach staff would get the testing to become a certified counselor, all of our medical assistants, and all of our staff nurses. So those three groups of people, we would have at least three people at each site who could offer and conduct rapid testing as needed. As part of their training, they have to do a local training, basic education, and counseling and education training with our local health department. They have to do the clear, complete training. Again, all of these trainings are offered through our local health department. And they have to do an annual update. We want to make sure that as things change, as testing technologies change, as medication for those who are positive change, that those staff who are educating our patients about it are also educated about the newest and greatest breakthroughs. We also decided that we wanted to make sure that our PCPs, our primary care providers, they needed to have some additional basic HIV care training. We had a little bit of provider pushback or hesitation and so had to get some buy-in from them. But I think once we started doing the education, giving them access to additional trainings, definitely all of the T4C webinars, all the trainings that are sponsored by the TAC, our primary care providers were encouraged to attend, participate in, and ask questions. We definitely started to get the feedback that we needed. And so those training opportunities definitely seem to be beneficial for us. So what was the additional support that we needed? In order for us to successfully implement routine testing, we had to expand our EHR system in order for it to allow us to really document everything that we needed. We know we wanted to not just track. I can track the patients who are tested according just to the testing technology. The same way with our regular labs, we can track it. It shows up in the electronic health record. But we also wanted to make sure that we were tracking those patients who were declining. So at some point in time, it's my goal, somewhere before the end of that project, is to really be able to do some type of focus group with those decliners, potentially, and try to get some idea as to why they declined the test. Was there hesitation? Did they not know enough? And what might be a reason or something that we could do, say, provide, that would help increase their compliance with routine testing? We also have to update our system in order to reflect the different testing technologies. So as Dr. Wendell referenced, there have been multiple different generations of tests. Our electronic health record system still referenced Western Blot because when we first started it, that was the lab that was used. And it referenced OraSure. So that text sort of automatic popped up when you clicked on the link. And we needed to make sure that we updated it, one, so that it reflected our most recent testing types, and to make sure that if we needed to select something different, that we had the ability to do it versus that text being an automated text. We also, again, like we said, we had to update our workflow process. What does it look like? How do our patients get routed through their visit differently now that we're introducing a little bit something that requires more education, a little bit more time during the visit? How do we make sure that the workflow is conducive to that? And we made sure that we established standing orders for our HIV-positive patients. So again, because HIV services had primarily been happening at one site, the testing had primarily been happening at one site, those staff seemed to know what needed to happen next when we had HIV positive patients. But now that we're extending routine testing to all of our sites, we wanted to make sure that we had standing orders no matter where a patient was seen, whether it was one of our HIV specific providers or another provider, everyone knew what that set of labs needed to be for any of our patients who were being introduced into care. The other thing that we needed to do was to revise our data collection forms. So basically, again, we wanted to make sure that we're still collecting the risk information. With rapid testing, that information was collected on a paper form. When we transitioned to routine testing, all of that's documented in our EHR system, but it didn't necessarily allow us to collect the risk information in the way that we wanted to see it. So that was something that we had to change the forms, that the way that the patients fill out when they first register, and then make sure that there was a way in the system for that also to be tracked. So what has happened since we've implemented routine testing? We've done a little over 2,000 routine tests during the last year, averaged about 170 tests per month. So you'll see if you look at the graph that March was the greatest. We had the highest number of tests in any particular month. And that was right after we did an organization-wide training, one of our all-staff meetings in February. Talked about it, asked a lot of questions. Our information session probably lasted the longest out of all of the presentations that happened that day. But that was great for me because what that meant was that there were other people in the organization who were interested, who wanted to have a conversation, who wanted to know what they needed to do. And the next month's testing showed it. So now we're working. Of course, we've had some dips, priority switching, different things happening. But one of the things that we do, we meet on a monthly basis, and then we provide an update to the staff overall every 3 months to make sure that we're continuing to remember that this is one of our processes. It's a routine process, so let's not forget it. We found that 35% of the patients who should have a test were actually tested. Unfortunately, that means 65% didn't, but that was definitely a growth and increase from where we were before we started routine testing. So we feel like we came far during our first year, but we definitely have a distance to go. But just a quick tidbit, one of the things that routine testing, when we looked at the definition of routine testing, it was really that the test is happening on the same day as a medical visit. But again, our center, as we talked about, we wanted to do the test as a part of their labs. If we had patients who had to do other labs, fasting labs, and had to come back for a separate lab-only visit, we felt that that was still a part of routine testing and wanted to include it. So that's not the reason why I showed the two separate, because we found that of those who were tested, about half of those who were tested, the test actually happened the same day of the visit. So that means they were able to have the visit, labs done same day, no problem. But the other half of them, they had to come back for a lab-only visit and have that test done. But the fact that the conversation around the routine test, the order for the test happened during a medical visit, we were still able to include that as part of our routine testing process and talk about those numbers as part of what we've done and been able to accomplish since we implemented routine testing. So where are we going? We've come far, but we've still got a long journey to go. And, of course, I'm reaching for the stars. So one of the things that we are working to do is really to increase compliance with the testing workflow across our sites. So we found that we have, at one, actually there are two of our sites that are working very well. When we go to the sites, they go to the site meetings, they give excellent feedback around the process. The patients have, we've actually got a lot of input back on the patient satisfaction surveys just around the fact that we're offering the testing. Patient seems to be happy about it. But we know that we have some more work to do. What's happening in that workflow process that we're wind up missing these patients that should be tested, and they're not even declining it? Or if they are declining it, the decline is not showing up in the system, so it still looks as if we missed them. So that's something that we're working to increase compliance with. Also, definitely sustainability planning specific to the lab costs for our uninsured patients. A huge portion of our population is self-pay or uninsured. Right now, the cost for it is covered by our grant. But when this grant funding ends, as all of us know, what do? We know that it's a valuable service. That's why we've invested as much time as we have. That's why we've invested even organizational funds that aren't necessarily grant funds in order to make this program what it is. But we know we need to make sure that we're building the foundation. We're looking ahead. We have a little bit more than 18 months left of this P4C funding. But we want to make sure that we've done what we need to do in order to make sure that we've introduced something great, we don't have to stop it because of a lack of funding. And last but not least, we definitely want to not forget our high-risk negatives. We know that we continue to have individuals just in HIV care period or in the HIV world period, patients are going to continue to engage in high-risk behaviors. So when we come across those patients, just because we've tested them, we know what their status is, right now it's negative, what do we do to make sure that they continue to remain negative? What other high-impact prevention modalities, evidence-based interventions can we do at our center in order to increase that, increase those services, link them to other services throughout our community? What's that going to look like? So those are discussions that we're having and looking forward to continuing to have. So basically, that's it. That's what we do in Broward. South Florida has been great to us. We've gotten a lot of support from just the whole overall P4C project. Our project officer has been great, answered a lot of our questions, given us direction in the areas that we needed, and I'm excited to be a part of the program.
Okay, thank you. We have a few moments here. We could take some questions. If you have any questions, please enter them into the questions pane on the GoToWebinar toolbar. We did have a couple that came in. How much time do your providers spend with scheduled patients?
Okay, is this specific to our HIV patients? So for our...
Yes, I'm assuming that, yes.
Sure. So if we look at it on our schedule, typically our established patients, we have established different codes for our patients who are coming in that are HIV positive, and we typically, those established patient spots are 15 minutes. They have the flexibility to stretch them as needed. The providers usually spend at least that amount of time with them. We have patients who need to be tested. So our new patient slots are 30 minutes. If we have patients who need to be tested, the requirement for more education happens. They have the flexibility to extend that visit as needed. But we typically have the slots allocated for either 15 to 30 minutes, and they have the ability to extend them as needed.
Okay. Are you providing once-in-a-lifetime testing or annual routine testing?
So as of right now, we are doing once-in-a-lifetime testing. We want to make sure that everyone was tested at least once. However, if they identify any risk, then we recommend either retesting in 3 to 6 months or annual testing, depending on what the risk is.
Okay. And are you targeting specific visit types like physicals, or are you testing during any visit type?
We are testing during any visit type. So we don't code separately. We don't have a separate visit type specifically for physicals. It's usually established or new. I think we have pre-op. We have specific ones if they're coming, if they're established patients are coming for follow-up visits, like either OB or HIV care team. But for the majority, we're looking, any patient who's coming in, if they don't have a documented test in their system, that those are patients we're targeting for a test.
Okay, and someone asked, what's the process for giving results?
So our providers are the ones who give back the test results for our blood-based tests. Typically, we get the results back within a couple of days. I don't think it's ever been more than 5 days when we've had a positive. Never been more than 5 days. And when the providers get the labs electronically, once they see the lab, they have to review it. If it's a positive, they automatically test. We have a patient care coordinator who's a part of the HIV care team, and she's the one who works to coordinate linkage to care for all of our positives. So he'll typically task her, again, all of this is electronic, asking her to have the patient recalled, pulled back in for early an appointment. So typically, if they've had any lab visit, their lab visit is scheduled, and they're automatically scheduled for a follow-up visit within 2 weeks of that lab. If it's a positive test result, the provider just may request that they come in sooner than the 2 weeks, as soon as we can get the patients in. For the negative test results, it's just getting back at the next visit, and typically those visits are 2 weeks after the lab has been completed.
Okay, another person asked, will the slides be available? And you can download those right now in the handout section on your GoToWebinar toolbar. There's a couple of handouts and the slides as well in PDF format. Okay, someone said, congratulations, great work. What percentage of your high-risk negatives follow up with the risk reduction counseling or interventions once referred?
We have not been able to capture that. So that's one of the things that I'm working on with our EHR team, and that was also why that was part of our next step, is to make sure, one, we found maybe about 6 months into it, I just felt that people are coming in, they're not having high risk, what's going on? As we started digging more and more through our system, we realized that staff weren't properly documenting risk, or they were entering the risk as free text, where when I run the report, it doesn't show up or it doesn't trigger anything. And so when the provider saw it, they didn't see, we basically have set the system up so that it sort of sends an alert during the visit, indicating that this is a patient that might need to be referred. But because they weren't doing the documentation properly, they were capturing it but weren't documenting it systematically. So then our EHR system couldn't do the alerts that we needed. That we weren't getting many referrals for risk reduction intervention. So that's why our PI team, we sat down, we sat down with the HIV care team and decided that we needed to be able to track it differently and updated our EHR. So I wish I could answer that differently.
Okay, another question is, do your patients have access to a patient web portal for their medical records? And if so, are negative results populated on this portal?
Yes, they have access to the portal. During this past year, that's another one of the projects that we've worked on. We have about, I'm trying to think, I know I just ran the report last month. Up until that point, we had close to 1,800 of our patients. This is a little bit less than 20% of our patients are actually registered on the portal. Negative results automatically go in there. Positive results do not. That was one of the things that we set up in the system to make sure that the positive results were not automatically showing up in the portal. We wanted to give the providers the opportunity to do really the post-test counseling and linkage to care and that not be something that getting the result without all of the information. We wanted to make sure that we interceded to that.
Okay, if anyone else has any questions, please enter them now.
If I could just add one other thing, just I'll take it back to the high impact prevention and the referral. So one of the things that we have found has worked really great for us, I think we have a smoking cessation program. I'm trying to think, there's one other group session that I just can't remember off the top of my head. But one of the things that we found is that when we have our HIV care team, again, there are about 9 staff members that are part of it, medical case managers, our care coordinators. We have MAs at each site that are considered part of our HIV care team. One thing that we have them do is to really talk about other services that are available. And so what we found is that when other people introduce the potential for, hey, did you know we have this? Oh, you had some questions. Have you ever thought about this? And the doing of a warm handoff has definitely helped with the referral. So, for instance, I know I'm thinking specifically of these 2 patients that we had where the provider was seeing the patient. The patient expressed a lot of concerns, things that were going on, and the provider called one of the medical case managers to come in and get a real live handoff, of course followed up by the documentation of the system. But that warm handoff was one of the things that we found. That patient has come back, and although they've had risk reduction counseling, not necessarily in a formal risk reduction intervention, when we've had some conversation, I've had some conversation with her specifically, and her, I'm sorry, we're having a birthday celebration next door. But when I spoke with her specifically, she said one of the best things was the fact that the provider brought the medical case manager in there with her at the same time. And so it made it easier for them to answer the questions, for her to trust this new person versus someone just saying, hey, you were referred to me, I'm calling to follow up. So that would definitely be one of the recommendations for anyone who's looking to do it. I would definitely say, to make sure that the team works as a team and that they were warm handoffs whenever the referrals are being made.
Okay. Any comments about the partnership notification process in your state?
Oh, well, we have a pretty good relationship. I would say a very good relationship with our DIS specialist. He is on site. He comes every Wednesday to our site, works with our care coordination, helps with regard to our patients who have lost the care, with our new positives, with doing partner notifications. So in all of the meetings that we've been having, and then we have a monthly meeting with our Department of Health as well during a case conference, it's never come up as an issue with regard to partner notification. We really sort of leave that to the Department of Health. And again, one of the things that we work to do, our care coordinator work to do, is to make that warm handoff to DIS, even as we're letting patients know this is part of the process in the state of Florida. Someone's going to be contacting you. I can tell you who it is. If you want, we can even make the arrangement for that conversation or change to happen at our site. I think working really closely with our DIS specialists, and we have one in Florida that's assigned specifically to our project, to our organization, and he's been great, and that's helped us not have any kickback, I guess.
Okay. Can you describe what testing during a non-medical encounter is?
Oh, basically just mean that the date that their HIV test conducted was not the same day as their medical visit. So let's say I had a medical visit today with my provider, but the other lab he wanted me to do required me to be fasting, so I can't do all of my labs today. instead of having the patients split their labs, we do some of them today, some of them the next time, we typically try to have our patients do all of their labs the same day, so they may schedule me to come back in 2 days or next week for a lab-only visit. So if the HIV test was done during that lab-only visit, but there's no, they're not having an interaction with a PCP, then it would be considered a non-medical visit or non-medical encounter.
Does anyone have any more questions? I'd like to thank everyone for all the awesome questions. Okay, I'm not seeing any more come in. Victor?
Just, Dr. Wendell, if you're there, do you have any final comments?
I guess I'd be interested if there are any participants who'd like to tell us if they know if their lab uses the CDC algorithm or not. But otherwise, I really appreciate this discussion. I think it was very valuable today.
Okay. Okay. All right, thank you. And just a reminder to all the to everybody attending today that you can go ahead and register for the third session beginning today. We will be sending out registration information via the listserv in the upcoming days. Okay. And just a reminder, first of all, I'd like to thank Ms. Brooks, Andrea Brooks from Broward Community Family Health Centers for participating today as our health center co-presenter. For those of you who also participated in the first session where we had the Whittier Street Health Center, we're looking for health centers to participate as presenters in our communities and practice and some of our other collaborative trainings. So I will be sending out more information on the listserv, but please feel free to email me if you're interested in participating in our collaborative trainings or in our communities of practice. We have this one on routine HIV testing, and we have another one starting up on electronic health records. So please don't be shy. We're looking for health centers to participate as well. We believe that all of the health centers can learn a lot from each other. And I think, today's questions is a true testament to that. And again, thank you to Ms. Brooks and to the Broward Community Family Health Center for participating today.
Okay, thank you for participating in today's webinar. Take care, everybody, and we'll see you next time.